Good evening. Thank you so much for being here to help me celebrate the 1960s. We all know this, but just a remark that it's a unique, creative, politically important, and continually appealing decade. We just keep talking about it somehow or other. Certainly that's the case with the 60s in this country, but perhaps even more in Great Britain. Probably everybody in this room knows this, but I'm Sarah Holliday, and I'm the head of events here at the New York Society Library. I've worked here for 18 years. But I'm also the author of a brand new book called A Thousand Dances, a novel of the British blues boom, which is what motivated our gathering this evening. And I just want to particularly thank everyone at the library who has been so supportive to me through this whole writing and publication and general swinging 60s event we've been having together for the last few years. So I thought I would tell you just a little bit about how this book came to be, which involves some fun slides. And I'm going to read just a touch, and then we'll move on to some other miscellaneous entertainment, which I hope will be entertaining. So how this book came to be, well, I'm going to move over here. I've been an Anglophile, as my mother would tell you, since I was a small child. But this book came along starting about 5 years ago, and it was sort of an accident. Nobody will be surprised to hear it started with these guys. They're so adorable. And my husband had been trying to get me deeply into the Beatles for a long time.
Since 1996.
Since 1996. And for some reason in 2010, the penny dropped, or whatever one might say about it, and the penny lane dropped, thank you. And I went up and being like, oh, the Beatles, yes, they're nice. They had a nice sound, whatever. People like, give me all the records of the Beatles and all the books about the Beatles and all everything about the Beatles. So I got very into their period and their sort of thing in the 60s. There's a few books related to 60s music over there, by the way. And then I got even more into some of their influences. These are just a couple, with Chuck Berry and Buddy Holly. And Smokey Robinson there, which you will probably be familiar with. So for several years there, then I was reading 60s music, I was breathing 60s music, come on in, folks. I was listening to 60s music all the time. I couldn't shut up about 60s music, etc. So then in August of 2013, bizarrely, Lincoln Center threw a David Bowie film festival. And this was really the weirdest thing that ever happened, because who would throw a David Bowie film festival? His films are terrible. Like, all his films are terrible. I mean, I love a couple of them, but they're bad. But I was a good child of the 80s, so we went to see Labyrinth, you know, like you do. And then we stayed for the double feature, and it was a movie called Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. Oh, that's other Beatles influences. We love these guys, too, right? I'm going to come back to one of those. Anyway, Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. 1983, here's Bowie over on the right, looking, you know, odd. And but he's not really the point here. The point is that this movie is set in a prisoner of war camp for mostly British and other English-speaking prisoners of war of the Japanese in World War II. And for some reason, from that movie, I got very interested in the experiences of the Far East prisoners of war. Happily, all the guys who survived that seem to have written a memoir in the library. It has many of them, a few of them are on that table as well. So there was plenty of reading to do on that. And then one day, in September of 2013, I'm walking down the street and I had this sudden realization, like, wow, the kids who made the music in the 60s were the children of the people who fought World War II. You know, which is completely obvious and yet just burst upon me like a metaphorical explosive device. And so, also, Far East Prisoner of War, this is actually art made shortly after Liberation Army was there. You may also remember the Bridge on the River Kwai, highly inaccurate movie, but from that same setting. About the same stuff. Some more lovely images from the Far East Prisoner of War experience. It was pretty terrible. You can read all about it if you like. Anyway, so I had this thought of what would it be like to be a kid in the early 60s when this fabulous music is just beginning to explode, and you're just starting to find yourself and define yourself and do that whole great coming of age thing. But you are from a family that has been hugely impacted by the situation of World War II. Your dad, in fact, is a survivor of the Tyburn Railway, the infamous Tyburn Railway. And so that's an influence on how you see the world and how you react when things go awry. So the book kind of unfolded from there, and as I have said to a few people, it was almost sort of an accident. It was really, I also said, sometimes all you need is one good idea, 300,000 volumes, which we happen to have in this building, by the way. So I did an enormous amount of research at the library as well as outside of it. I kind of had this thought, and I did a little speculating, a little outlining, and I thought, you know, this might turn into a novel. And a remarkable number of people have acted like that. It was a cool thing to have done, to be working on a novel, because I have been working here, and I'm very fortunate. And so tonight, here we have the fruits of all of that. Now, Thousand Dances is a novel of British bluesmen. I just want to give one announcement and a couple of shout-outs. Shout-outs including Robert Dunn, who is the publisher of Coral Press, who's publishing the book, so thank you very much. Also, you may have noticed that we had the book for sale out in the Peluso Family Exhibition Gallery. I'm afraid it is now sold out of the copies we have with us this morning. Well, thank you, but it's good news and good news because my friend Nick Jason is over here and happens to share his name with my protagonist. We'll be happy to take your orders. He is from the corner bookstore, 930 Madison. Fantastic people, go see them. But you don't have to go see them to get a copy of the book. You can place an order with Nick if you'd like one signed. If you just like one period, it can come here and we will get it to you from here. So feel free to talk to Nick after this. I'll also be sitting down here and signing copies of those who did manage to buy one before we sent out. So thank you for all of that. So the book, August 1963, in London and its suburbs, we meet a guy named John Nicholas Philip Spinnery, or Nicky, who hangs out at the local teen music club, the Cherrystone Ballroom, and hears all the latest bands that make it out to the suburbs. And everything is fine and dandy until one night at the club, they find a dead teenager in the bathroom in the lower level, and his life kind of goes awry. And so the book is a little bit of a mystery. It kind of is him trying to figure out what went wrong, but it's not a traditional detective mystery. It's got that as one thread of the plot. It's got lots of music, because part of what he ends up doing is going around to all the other clubs and trying to track down bits and pieces of what happened to this kid and where he had been and all this sort of thing. And it has quite a lot to do with his dad, the veteran of various interesting things. We'll get more back into that later on. And various other characters in his community. So, if it's okay with you, I'm going to read a little passage, and I'm going to continue to stand here because there's some images that go with it. Back. These are all vintage images from early 60s club scenes in Britain. They were pretty dank places. They were not really beautifully decorated or anything like that. As you can see there, if you are Liverpool pop fans, you may recognize the people in the middle lower left. Anybody? That is Jerry Marston of Jerry the Pacemakers dancing with Cilla Black.
Wow.
Aren't they cute? Okay, so, a passage. My mate Eddie had got his pay yesterday afternoon and immediately spent it at Imhoff's record shop. Now he was showing off his prizes to us, Roy, Susie, me, and of course, Luz. We were sitting on the train station wall opposite the Cherrystone Ballroom, the one site for live music in St. Agnes Village. Trying to be all things to all people, the Cherrystone Ballroom offered modern jazz on Tuesday nights and trad on Thursdays. Fridays and Saturdays were the nights for the best music, live rhythm and blues, and drew 70 or 80 local kids. The owner did manage to book a few talented groups, or at least ones who could imitate the real artists. The ballroom had all the charm of the cement warehouse it had once been, but it was ours. The R&B club crowd bolted their tea so as to start admiring or criticizing each other by 6 o'clock every Saturday. By 7, when records started blaring through the PA system, we were queued at the door, eager to pay a shilling ahead to pack onto the hard dance floor and bury the week in the music. Eddie flourished another record, The Hollies, Searching. I liked their first one, said Roy. If all they ever want to do is speed up songs by the Coasters, I sniffed. It's new this week. How did you already hear it? Eddie said. I slung my gaze over at Luce, who was fiddling aloofly with her Kodak Brownie 9mm. Someone spun it at Marshall's music shop. I was hanging about waiting for Luce to finish drawing naked people. The lad sniggered. The human body is beautiful and deserves detailed study, Luce lectured in a superior tone. Besides, she half-grinned, the nudes don't come until next term at least, juveniles. Luce, Lucinda Hatchell, is 15 months older than me and the next thing to my big sister. She'd started art college the autumn before and was now incomprehensible a lot of the time. She was currently consumed by an intensive two-week drawing course in advance of term. She did still condescend to visit the club on a Saturday night, though. She brought a camera up to her eye and focused it on me. Eddie elevated a long player like the host. Now, you can't have heard this one, he challenged me. James Brown's live at the Apollo. Mine's practically worn out, I replied, smirking. I snatched it up at Transat Imports last month. Eddie stuffed the records back into his messenger bag, shaking his head indulgently. We've been having this essential exchange since I founded our secondary school record club. Don't I see one more, Susie halted him. Is it silly? Is it Cliff Richard? It's Pat Boone, Roy suggested. His stunning performance on Ready, Steady, Go converted you. Oh, shut your cake, said Eddie. It's these Northerners. He flashed us a shiny new 12-inch record, Please, Please Me. Four floppy-haired Beatles grinned gauntlessly down the stairwell. Half the obligers in school have grown their fringes out like this lot, Roy complained. They look like poofs. They were practically giving them away, Eddie protested too much. No surprise they topped the hit parade. They looked at me. Their first single's not bad, I judged. Good harmony. Somebody plays a nice mouth organ line. The final word from Nicky Spinnery, one-man jukebox jury, said Luce, filming me. Of course, her camera got no sound. It was far over my head why she bothered. Did you see that program last night, Ready, Steady, Go, Roy asked. As long as they're booking some rhythm and blues, I'll watch it, said I. If Luce is watching anyway. The Hatches had telly. I swear we were the last house in the village that didn't. I wouldn't mind meeting that dusty Springfield in the dark alley, Eddie started to say. But his meditation on charms of Ready, Steady, Go's hostess was cut off by the insistent whir of Italian motor scooters. Here comes Lord Snooty, Luce remarked, as a crowd of sharp-cut lads swerved into the square, flashing their mirrors. In front was a tall, well-built boy astride the trendiest model of Lambretta scooter, royal blue and chrome. It matched his blazer, white, with narrow blue stripes. Black tape on his windscreen proclaimed him Dennis Brown. That's D-E-N-Y-S. Dennis was the local face. He'd been dubbed the Lambretta trendsetter by one of the puppy-like admirers who doted on such shite as clothes and shoes. A cloud of chips descended on him as soon as he screeched to a halt. He was sporting a new haircut, center-parted, blow-dried chocolate color. Next week, every lad but me would be wearing it. And back when his name was plain Dennis, D-E-N-N-I-S, he went to primary school with me. The last class I had with him, he cribbed off my paper and got us both sent to the head teacher. A few weeks later, he passed the exam that took him up to the esteemed local grammar school, while I didn't scrape it and went on to the middling secondary modern. This he tossed to my face twice weekly in the church choir. When our voices broke, he still managed to leave me with an unflattering nickname. I never held a grudge toward anyone but Dennis Brown. You must admit he does pull it off, said Susie apologetically. If you think that's a worthwhile use of your time, I grumbled. Luce had a camera filming Dennis and his hangers-on. Along with setting the club style, they often opened for the contract group, the chicks clamored to carry in their guitars. They're picturesque, Luce explained when I jostled her elbow. Years from now, they'll be museum pieces and I'll have the footage. What's the word on tonight's group, Nix? Eddie asked. I searched my brain for the detours. I'd been studying the New Musical Express when my peers still thought Beano was the height of culture. They're from Acton. They've not recorded yet. I think the frontman was lead guitarist until recently. So they may be rotten, said Roy. Dunno, said I. You should head in if you want to beat the queue. Into the square rolled a battered maroon van with a big white arrow painted down the side. Tonight's headliners were arriving at the last minute. My mates faded into the queue and I strolled down the alley behind the ballroom. The van had indeed pulled up at the loading dock that passed for a stage door. Four leather-jacketed lads were piling out with guitars and other gear. I met a lot of musicians in those days. It was easy. I just offered help and didn't compete with them. The musos weren't gods then. They were every kid you knew who talked his parents into paying installments on an instrument. Hello, hello, I said to the nearest chap. Welcome to the Cherrystone. You work here? Said he. Just a regular. Give you a hand with your kit, though, if you like. As long as it gets inside, said a square-jawed kid with a wicked smile. The last stranger who helped us load in tried to make off with the drums. Roger caught him, though. Yeah, I think his cast come off this week, boasted the indicated Roger. He was a short, broad bloke with an aggressive chin and incongruous blonde curls. He smacked the van's back doors with his palm, and they popped open, revealing a mountain of gear and one more boy, long-legged with lank black hair. He handed me a microphone stand, and I reached for an instrument case. Don't touch that, he ordered. Take this amp, if you can. The amp was enormous, but strangely light. For one horrid moment, I juggled it, then found my balance. You want this anywhere in particular? Just against the back wall, said the long-legged boy. The way we play, the acoustics don't much matter. With a stack this size, they'll hear you in three counties, acoustics or no, I said. You want to know the secret, said the square-jawed kid. Only the box is big. The tubes are standard size. Don't tell. That you exaggerate the size of your equipment, I bantered, swinging up onto the dock. How do the birds feel about that? This got a whoop of laughter. No complaints yet, Roger called. About our equipment. The music is another story, said the long-legged boy. I'm Peter, by the way. Roger over there. That's John, Barney, and the old man's Doug. Nick, I said. Glad to know you. In front of me, the stage door opened to show Dennis Brown and his loathsome sidekick, Andy Drivers, framed in the dim light. Good evening, drawled Dennis. I'm Dennis Brown, lead singer of the Selwyns. I'll be glad to orient you. That's quite a stack you've got here, innit, gents, remarked Andy, who was habitually amped up himself and had the stamina to prove it. Oh, but you're good and loud, aren't you? Aren't you? We're loud, at any rate, said Peter, leaning his guitar case gently against the piano and heading back out to the van. I raised the mic stand to usable height and turned to find Dennis's green eyes narrowed at me. You just love to be on stage, Ace. Spindly, he hissed, sounding just like primary school. Get out of this and let the professionals handle it. Don't flatter yourself, I said. Are you not a muser then, Nick, said Peter, setting down a second amp. Does anyone go to a club to hear other blokes play? Me, I said. I'd love a job in the music business, but all I play is records. Where's this go? Bit of drum kit, said Doug, relieving me of it. Hear a lot of good groups, Nick, Barney inquired, holding a drum for Doug to screw into place. Not out here. Chris Barlow in the city, the Rolling Stones and the Ricky Tick in Windsor, Manfred Mann, all the people who poach the same songs we do, said Peter gloomily. You reckon stuff from the Bluebeat label, Nick? Sure, we were just talking about Desmond Dekker. Oh, Bluebeat is where it's at, Dennis interjected, popping his gum. Do you go to the Flamingo? We danced there all night last weekend, Andy added. Mad it was, mad. Everyone high as fucking kites. Above our heads, the PA crackled to life, the instant good time sound of the Miracles shop around. Kids, well-dressed, ill-dressed, my friends, schoolmates, and neighbors poured through the front doors and plunged into the current dance craze. The night was underway. Nicky and Luce bring the coppers around, and it looks like suicide. But on the other hand, Nicky notices that Dennis Brown has disappeared by the time the police show up. Nicky starts to suspect that the Lambretta trendsetter might know more than he's telling, and thus the plot unfolds. So I have one other much, much shorter excerpt, but you've got to meet the other major character in the book. So now we're at number one, Church Row, in the fictional town of St. Agnes. So Mickey lives with his dad, whom he calls the Brigadier, or the Brig. The Brig works as a church sexton, but in his glory days, he was a professional song and dance man. So in the variety circuit, or the music hall circuit. And then he was a soldier and a prisoner of war. And by the way, between the first segment I read and this one, for complicated reasons, the Brig has forbidden Nicky to go back to the Cherrystone Ballroom this week, so he's going to mention that. Monday morning, I awoke to the Brig's voice chatting to the milkman downstairs. Mr. Suggs not only brought some milk and butter, but also left his morning paper, minus the football scores. Morning, Mr. Suggs, I said as I reached the bottom of the stairs. Washing day, the Brig reminded me. Mondays were his day off for domestic chores. I was fortunate to live with a former Army Batman, but I didn't feel that way when I had to put off breakfast just to empty my hamper. I groaned as I turned back up the stairs. If you'd prefer to wash it yourself, that can be arranged, the Brig called after me. When I came back, tugging my laundry bag, the Brig was waving Mr. Suggs on his way. I relieved him of the milk bottle and went into the kitchen to stash it in the hay box beneath the sink. Nothing would stay fresh long in the warm weather. The sky had clouded over since yesterday, as if in honor of Monday. I turned on the kitchen radio. The BBC played cheery old music. If I didn't have to go to work, I'd take the radio upstairs and try to tune it to Armed Forces Network, broadcasting to occupying troops on the continent. Blissful interludes of American rock and jazz and blues between segments of propaganda-flavored news. The Brit came in with his nose in the paper. The Profumo aftermath still filled the front page. Hope and glory, my dad exclaimed. What's the world coming to? What? I doubted he was talking about the recent political scandal. They're tearing down the Glasgow Empire to put up an office block. It's simply a crime. I thought you were in favor of tearing down empire, I needled him. Clever hogs, he said. I topped the bill there in, well, I believe it was the last summer before the war. I collected the porridge tin and a saucepan. Don't tell me, you were a great hit and they wouldn't stop shouting your name. He laughed. Nah, I died on the ass. They hate Englishmen up there, and they stopped serving the bevy after the first show. I only topped the bill because I lost a wager. He laid the paper flat on the table. Want a boiled egg? Sure, cheers, said I. Eggs in the basket? Have at 'em. Think you're funny, don't you? I snorted. He shrugged. They did, everywhere but the Glasgow Empire. I lit the burner under my saucepan of porridge. We were too economical for Rice Krispies in this house. Please recall I'm not your straight man. What use is it having children if they won't be a straight man, he lamented. That reminds me, I said, and then rushed on. No Cherryston, but if I were to stay out in the city some night this week? He gave me that owlish look again. His short-sightedness, another legacy of the war, made him appear to look right through me. Finally, he said, only if loose can go, and you're careful. The slightest sign of trouble, you come straight home. I'm always careful, I protested. I just really want the music. I don't care about the whole scene. You know that. He half-smiled. After all, he did understand about the music. I know. Thanks, Brig, you're the best. Don't make me regret that now, he added, scanning the paper. The good people at the Daily Herald don't think I should be so liberal. I looked at the article upside down, registering words like youth, wild, and gangs. Apparently, you lot are incited to riot by jungle music from America, he went on. Jungle music, indeed. They never seen a jungle in their lives. They're just peddling panic. Adolescents were precisely the same when I was one myself, precisely. Better music, mind yourself. Of course, we weren't taking all this dope they talk about here. We stuck to good, clean drink. But you don't care for any of that. It makes me ill, except the cigarettes. He wiggled an eyebrow. I cleared my throat and spooned porridge into a bowl. At very least, I said lightly, blowing on a spoonful, I assure you I'm not feeling particularly inclined to riot. I'm not so sure about that, he said absently, reading. The radio was musing about the American Dr. King who'd just given some wonderful speech. It's just, I began, not sure what I wanted to say. The Brit lifted his head and peered at me through his thick lenses. You're still thinking of that dead boy. The kids just seemed so unbothered by it, I confessed. Maybe my generation are as heedless as the papers say. He considered this. Sometimes something affects a person, but he doesn't show it till later. But I'm the same. I keep imagining his parents. He trailed off, but I didn't need him to articulate his worst nightmare. Or, in his case, perhaps it wasn't his worst. Used to perform back in the 1930s, and my husband, Gabe Random, is a very gifted lyricist, wrote the words for these that are in the book, which is lovely, and our excellent friend Paul B. Patinella wrote some tunes to them, so I thought I would sing them for you.
Come on.
1940s on this lapel in the 1960s. So, song. And I mention it particularly because my main character mentions it several times in the book. It's actually his favorite song and the song that really turned him on to the blues. Anybody? Good guess, but not quite. Yeah, I know
Big Mama Thornton.
There she is, hanging out with Muddy Waters, by the way, as awesome people did.
You ain't not the
It's on record, but it's extremely good. Go look up Big Mama Thornton. Fantastic voice.
Why did they call her Big Mama?
I'm going to leave that to you. Next slide, please. So this is the Ealing Club. I actually took these photos in 2015. It's at the end of a train line out from London to the neighborhood of Ealing in West London. And this has a blue plaque on it claiming that it's actually where the British blues boom, or the British rhythm and blues boom, was born in 1962. Now that's, you know, you could dispute that kind of thing forever, but it does have some considerable claim to fame, and many of the early British artists who wanted to be like the American blues artists did play at the Ealing Club, which was just as lovely a place in the 60s as it looks to be in 2015. it's no longer a club. I'm not sure what it is now, but the doorway is still there and so forth. Anyway, so this next track, I'm gonna play you a little bit of, next slide please. Is Cyril Davis, who is the plump guy playing the harmonica there. He is very little known these days, and it's too bad. It's partly because he died in his late 30s, or his mid-30s, in 1964. So right on the cusp of everybody, he had inspired and trained becoming famous, like the Rolling Stones, for instance. Mick Jagger credits him as one of the people who taught him to play the harmonica. Mick Jagger is a pretty darn good harmonica player, so that's really kind of saying something. But Davis was an amazing harmonica player and one of the people who many touring American musicians wanted to play with, even though, of course, you know, they had wonderful blues harmonica players in the U.S. because he was so accomplished. So this is just a taste. So you can listen to them all in one sitting. It's very easy to do. Fantastically talented guy. Now the other person, there's lots of awesome people in these photos, by the way, but the other one I want to point out right now is the guy seated in the top left photo. He's the same fellow, but with more mustache in the lower right photo. That is Alexis Corner, who's the other ancestor of the British blues boom. And here's just a nice kind of thing. This is actually Davis singing, and you may know this song.
Thank you.
some more of it with a little bit of recording quality, which is in our next slide. Who knows who this guy is? Anybody? You go to the Flamingo Club, 1962, 1963, and you stay late into the night, and you're going to meet Georgie Fame, who, again, not so well known now, but he's still around, he's still performing. He got to be a little bit more of sort of a singer-songwriter with soft guitar or whatever later on, but early on he was really very driven in blues, and he had a really, really kicking band of people from all over the world. You can see that in the lower left there. He was a little sandwich. If you can see on the slide there on the left of the record, this is a very early project supervised by Phil Spector, which explains a few things about their sound. Even early on, he kind of his specific thing on that. You may also, if you are a fan of this era of music, which I think many of you are, you may already know this version by Sly.